Well, I know people are curious who the President of the United States is, but it's an interesting... We'll have to wait.
It just shows up. What other shenanigans are going on the rest of the country?
Well, yeah, I'm sure. When it's
Florida.
Don't you wonder about election practices everywhere else?
Well, yeah, once you start talking about re-examining votes, like someone is even talking about having a re-vote, having them
the
vote
whole
again.
Country.
No. Not the whole county, but the whole county, that county.
Yeah.
So just re-vote again. Interesting. Okay.
Well, they probably should have the whole state of Florida.
Okay.
Well, Nader took away a lot of
votes. Yeah. Well, Nader said that Gore took a lot of votes away from him.
Yes, I heard that.
I loved
her.
So halachically, what's going to be?
Halachically. Yeah.
I know. This is the whole thing, you know,
democracy.
Talking about when we talk about conquering and Joshua
right.
and all the nastiness or that goes on and cruelty. And this is exactly what I was thinking. Look at this. I'm very upset about what's happening, but so quiet, so peaceful, there's no revolution.
That's very, very true.
There's going to be a peaceful, you know, trying
whatever
to turn
it'll be, it'll be
a Al Gore spoke very well. I was listening to NPR when I walk in the morning,
right.
and he spoke very well about, you know, whatever will be, whatever the outcome is, we need to go after it. And in another country, there would be bloodshed yeah. already.
Although you heard the excerpts of the conversation when Gore came up to retract his concession.
No, what he said.
So Bush says, "Let me see. I understand you. Are you telling me you're revoking your concession?"
Concession yeah.
So he says, "You don't have to be snippety about it."
Well, it's very funny because you know the midnight comedians. You know, they showed it this morning on TV, and the cutest thing is I can't remember which one said that Bush went to his parents and he said, "But you promised me."
Yeah, that was very
sorry, so cute.
Well, he said that he wasn't nervous, but his parents were falling apart, so he sent them back to Houston. So there they would go.
My brother was a huge answer. Remember that man at the end of the session last night?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if the issue is an answer or a difference of opinion, essentially. I mean, basically, I believe that in the Torah there are supernatural events, and therefore my own approach is that we don't have to explain away the occurrence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu changing the natural order. And therefore, now granted, the way the miracle is described, that the sun stopped, could not be the way it occurred, since the sun is not in revolution around the moon, but the concept of the day being longer than it would normally be, again, I'm perfectly willing to say, you know, if you believe in the splitting of the Red Sea, and you believe in the 10 plagues, and you believe in the miracles that happened at Mount Sinai, this is yet another example of a miracle. I'm not sure how else to explain it. You could explain it metaphorically, for example. If you wanted to, you could say, well, when God gives you the energy and the strength to keep on going through the night, it's as if the day was made longer. It's possible to say those things, but clearly the biblical text does not suggest that. Yeah.
One thing that occurred to me was that a group of scientists wrote about humans.
Right.
I don't think that they want to engage in study where they look for rational scientific explanations.
Well, there is, you know, there is the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists, which is a well-known organization, which has, they're mainly involved in medical ethics, although they do have a lot of physicists and people who are involved in this. For example, if you've read the works of Gerald Schroeder and Natan Abiezer, they attempt to reconcile the biblical account of creation with modern ideas of cosmology, the Big Bang Theory and everything else, and evolution, age of the earth. So there is an attempt to reconcile all those things. But even those people who want to reconcile creation with the laws of physics, I think do acknowledge that there are miraculous interventions which are not subject to the laws of nature. In other words, you don't attempt to rationalize everything, which, by the way, it's interesting. You know, people ask the question all the time, why doesn't God do miracles today? And the truth is, no, miracles happen all the time, but we don't always notice them. We say in the Yamidah, only secha shebechol yom imanu, because of the miracles that surround us every day. But what would happen if today the Red Sea would split? Let's say the same thing that happened, the Red Sea would split. Well, undoubtedly, the New York Times would run an article saying that scientists at MIT have speculated that the following thing happened. In other words, if you don't have the orientation of seeing divinity in various phenomena, you will always try to find some natural cause. You know, even the fellow who wrote about the Bible codes, Michael Drasnan, you saw his book. Michael Drasnan is in a strange predicament because he very much believes in the concept of the Bible codes, that through spacing of letters you could see future events, but he doesn't believe in God. A difficult combination. So he comes to the conclusion that some visitors from another planet who had the capacity to see the future somehow encoded these events. And that makes more sense. So you see that if a person has an inclination not to be a believer, there's nothing that will convince them. So the idea that, oh, if only God would do a miracle, I would be convinced, is just not always true. Now, the truth of the matter is, it's much more difficult to explain a long day than to explain a long night. A long night, we could identify with a sudden, a sudden eclipse. There are, right, the day turning into dark, that you see. The concept of a long day is very, very difficult to explain unless the moon was unusually bright or something. So I don't have the same difficulty as the gentleman had, simply because if we acknowledge the possibility of the supernatural, then we have, you know, supernatural. But if you don't acknowledge it, you have problems in how to reconcile biblical narratives, undoubtedly. But this would not be the only question. You'd have this question over and over and over again.
It says, the grass grows for children of Adam. The Torah talks so you, no, not you, you are above us. You and I, you and I can understand.
Yeah.
So that's why it's Yad Hashem, God doesn't have a head, it doesn't talk.
In other words, it uses physical expressions, anthropomorphic expressions.
To,
yeah.
So for us mortals to understand it.
That's right, that's correct.
But don't take it literally.
I understand that we would not take it literally that the sun stopped, because really it would have to be the earth stopped. But I think we do take it literally that the day did not end. The day went on for 36 hours, Machlokas the Gemara actually, 36 hours, 48 hours. It's a question of how long that day was. And as I indicated last week, according to the Talmud, even though it says this was unique because God listened to Yahushua's order, in fact, there were even later occurrences where this happened. If you remember the story of Nachdimon ben Gurion, the fellow that had borrowed water from the Romans and he had promised to pay them back before the end of the day, and God caused the sun to remain shining. So, you know,
there's a Mishnah?
That's a story in the Gemara of Nachdimon ben Gurion. Yeah. So, you know, that's an issue. Now, I did see that there are medieval philosophers, for example, the Ralbag. The Ralbag is a very controversial person. Rav Levi ben Gershon. He has a commentary on the prophets, but he also was one of the great medieval Jewish authors. In fact, he was the grandson of Ramban, of Nachmanides. So his yichus is very great. He also was
Ben
Gershon. Gershon. He also was a very noted astronomer, and in fact, there is a I think there's a comet named after him, the Gersonides comet or something. It was really one of the great.
Grandson of Nachmanides?
He was a grandson. He was the son of Ramban's sister, Ramban's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And in every Megillat Gedolot, in every standard Tanakh with commentaries, you will see the commentary of the Ralbag. But the Ralbag's commentaries on the VM are not controversial. They're very traditional. But his philosophical works are very iconoclastic. So I think in various places he more or less denies miracles, and he goes to attempts to explain things in natural ways. But as I say, that goes against the mainstream. And the history of the Ralbag was similar to the history of Maimonides, in which there was a lot of controversy, and some of his philosophical books were banned. But of course, as great as he was, he didn't have the prestige of Maimonides. So in fact, the Ralbag was suppressed a lot longer than was Maimonides' own works. But again, so the problem that was raised was a problem that did bother some, but it doesn't bother many others because they just acknowledge the concept of supernatural intervention. Anyway, but again, I think it's very, very significant. One of the things we have to ask ourselves is, not merely what was the miracle, but what does the miracle teach us? And I think, as I pointed out, and I'll just repeat this again, the miracle is very significant because it occurred in a war that we were not fighting for ourselves. It occurred in a war that we were fighting to protect the Givonim, with whom we had made a peace treaty, from being attacked. And that indicates, once again, the obligation of keeping our word, the obligation of not desecrating God's name by mistreating those who have come to you seeking refuge and protection, even though their behavior involved a certain element of fraud and misconduct. And therefore, God himself joins in the fight to protect the Givonim from being destroyed by their enemies. And it's also important to remember that although, for example, you had the king of Yerushalayim, the king of Hebron, fighting against Yehoshua, attacking the Givonim, and the Yehoshua was victorious, but he did not yet conquer the cities. He was victorious in driving away the army and in inflicting casualties. But the actual conquest of these cities, particularly Yerushalayim, does not occur until later. And in fact, as we will see as we go through, Yerushalayim was conquered in stages. Some of it was in the time of the judges. Parts of it was not conquered until the time of David HaMelech. In fact, that whole question, when they celebrated a few years ago, the 3,000th anniversary of Jerusalem. So the truth is, it's a little confusing because it was really uncertain 3,000 years from what. And they figured they were trying to count 3,000 years from David HaMelech's conquest of the city, although it wasn't quite accurate. It was probably something like 2,950, but they figured it was a good time for a celebration, so they wanted to make it at that point. Okay. Again, as you read, I think we're in the middle of chapter 10, Perek Yud. This is the conclusion of the war in which the sun stopped, and the five Canaanite kings that were leading the struggle, they in themselves abandoned their army, and they hid in caves. And basically, the story that is described is that the Jewish army was aware that they were in caves, and they rolled big stones at the mouth of the caves, and the kings were in effect trapped. And at the end of the struggle, the kings were brought out, and there's actually a description of something that might be fairly humiliating. The kings were forced to lie down, and Yehoshua instructed the generals to put their foot on the neck. Symbolic, doesn't mean just to show that they were totally subjugated. And then these people were killed, and they were held up, they were hung up on a tree, and their bodies remained there until the evening. And upon the evening, the bodies were then removed and were given a type of burial. They were buried in the caves that they were hiding in, and there were big stones that were placed there as a monument. Again, some of this strikes us as, I don't want to say barbaric, or maybe a hard term. The truth is there are worse things that are yet to come. But basically, consistent with the idea that, number one, the seven nations of Canaan that did not make shalom with Bnei Israel were supposed to be eradicated. Number two, the idea that these were very fearsome and fierce nations, and therefore, in order to inspire confidence in the Jewish people that they would be able to be successful, there needed to be this additional element of humiliating or subjugating the leaders. And number three, the idea of hanging a body, but then taking it down by nightfall, is actually recorded in the Torah itself. The Torah says, when there is capital punishment and people are executed for Aveirot, so the halakha is, in order that people should see and be afraid to commit the crime, meaning capital punishment was regarded as a deterrent in the Torah, general deterrent, the body should be displayed. But there is a halakha that the body must be buried no later than nightfall, because it is considered to be a humiliation to God that a human being be exhibited in that way. Very, very interesting. Ki kilolas Elokim taloi. A bat kilolat Elokim taloi. The hanging up of a human body, a taloi, the hanging up of a human body is kilolat Elohim. It is, as it were, a reproach or a curse to God. God is being degraded when human beings who are made in God's image are degraded. So God, as it were, yields his honor for the sake of the deterrence implicit in the act of hanging. But God says, only for a short time. And in fact, according to rabbinic tradition, it's very different. According to rabbinic tradition, the body was not hung up until right before sunset. It was just like a flag, up and down. It was not there for hours. Or No. I'm quoting, when the Torah talks about that, the Torah is talking about people who are executed for aveirot.
So
as far as we know, I'm sorry,
where is the deterrent, the need for deterrence here?
Well, no, the need for deterrence here is very clear, because there are still other kings that they're going to be fighting, and the other kings and the other city-states should see what happens to the kings.
Oh, it's not for the benefit of the Israelites.
No, not only that. Here, right, that's correct, that's correct, that's correct.
Right.
No, the deterrence in the Torah is for other Jews,
exactly,
not to commit these aveirot. Here, the deterrence is that the Umot HaOlam should see that you don't mess with the Jewish people, and therefore this would discourage them from those similar types of battles. So you have a similar idea of deterrence. That is the idea of Taliyah. Now, did God specifically command that it be done here? As far as I can see, there is no divine command to that effect. Presumably, Yehoshua is drawing an analogy from what the Torah generally said. But again, you're going to have things, questions that you could raise is, well, Yehoshua did not do this in every battle. Right? Just like we'll see another detail coming up. In other words, there are sometimes you see unusual features which Yehoshua employed in one case and did not employ in another case. For example, in Jericho, there was the unusual feature that the shalal of Jericho, the spoils of Jericho, had to be destroyed, which was not true for any other war. We're going to read in chapter 11 of an unusual and difficult thing that was done, in which horses, their tendons were cut, which was only done in this one battle with Chatzor that we will see. Well, we'll discuss that when we get to it. Here you have the case of the Malachim being hung. So there were different strategies that were employed in order to inspire fear in the hearts of the Umot HaOlam, but it was recognized that psychological warfare is also a component of warfare, as we know to this very day.
Sunshine. Yeah. And I've read about examples of this, what they did, and sometimes Jews would sneak out to cut them down during the night, probably to try to observe this.
Yeah. Well, we read Yehoshua conquers a city and wipes out all of its inhabitants, right? So you say, well, that's what the Nazis did. I mean, certainly it's true. The Nazis would wipe out a city. Yehoshua wiped out a city. The fact is that if you define a cause as a just cause, again, this is where you get into difficult questions, because in the mind of a Nazi, the eradication of Jews might have been a just cause. You get into that issue, but the point is that's really a trap. It's a trap to say, well, we think we had a just cause, they think they have a just cause, therefore we're both the same. I mean, the point is that if one predicates one's life on a belief in God and on a belief in God's commandments, that itself would give them a sense of what is just. Now, I do want to recall one point to you. There's a very interesting reference in the Book of Kings that's quite relevant, and it's a very interesting contrast and even inconsistency with what we see in Yehoshua and what we see in the Book of Kings. In the Book of Kings, it is recounted that there was a war of the Jewish nation against Aram, which is Syria, Aram. And at some point, when Aram was in a bad situation, it mentions that some Aramean soldiers actually wanted to desert and go over to the Israelite side, because they said, if we are taken prisoners by Bnei Israel, we will be clothed and fed and taken care of. Unlike the situation that when our nation takes prisoners of the Jewish people. Meaning, it was known even in antiquity that the Jewish people, although they fought wars for defense or for conquest and the like, were generally considered to be humanitarian to those who were willing to give up the struggle and surrender. And Ad Kedei Kach, it was similar actually to the Gulf War. If you remember, a lot of Iraqis wanted to surrender to the United States because they would get more food and better medical treatment by being an American POW than they would get in their own army and as part of their own people. So on one hand, the Book of Malachim does say that among the Jewish people it was known even in antiquity that there was a certain compassion and estimation for POWs and prisoners of war. At the same time, we look at the Book of Yoshua and we see all sorts of things. You know, the Pasuk mentions city after city. Yeah. Not a single person, right, just goes like a bulldozer. Not a single person, particularly in chapter 10, was left alive. And then we have other things like hanging the kings, not just killing them, but hanging them up. And then we have even various pain that was inflicted on animals that you see.
And, yeah. When did Yeshua not obey God when he was told to kill animal and children and everybody else?
Now you're thinking, this is Shaul, King Saul, not Yeshua. This is King Shaul, who was commanded to kill Amalek, and he spared the sheep and the king of Amalek, from whom Haman eventually came. That's much later. Right now we're still with Yoshua. So the point is there are two different visions going on here. And even within Yoshua itself, the Givonim deceived Bnei Yisrael, and yet Bnei Yisrael kept their Brit. So apparently there is this divine command to eradicate the seven nations of Canaan, but when you don't have that specific divine command, the normal response is a certain measure of compassion and consideration. So there are multiple visions here, and it's hard to give a completely consistent account of what's going on, but you do have those. I just wanted to at least counterbalance the Yehoshua account with what we read in the Book of Kings, in the Book of Malachim. And then the rest of Perek Yud simply enumerates a city after city after city that was conquered, usually in one line or two lines. And each one, it talks about Lo Hishir Sarit, not a remnant was left, which seems to indicate, if you read it literally, every single person in the city was killed. It is possible, however, not to translate it that dramatically. It means there was not a remnant of power or authority left in the city. It doesn't have to refer totally to the total eradication of life, but it could just be an expression, as it were, that there was no power base left in those cities. But again, keep in mind that Bnei Israel are conquering the land of Israel city by city, inch by inch by inch. They're not getting all of it at once. And in fact, the Torah says that is actually to our benefit. The Torah says it. The Torah says in the Book of Exodus, you will not conquer the land all at once, because then you would have a big land with only a small population, a relatively small population, to inhabit it. There is a fear that you will be overrun by the wild animals of the field. Therefore, God is saying, until your population grows, the Canaanite populations will remain in effect, settling and cultivating and creating a society. So the whole concept was there would be a gradualism in conquest, and according to rabbinic tradition, although it's not explicit, it took 7 years for Yehoshua to conquer the land of Israel. In fact, the way we prove it is we're going to read that Kalev goes to Yehoshua at the end of the military conquest and says, I'm 85 years old today. And we know that Kalev was 40 years old at the time of the spies in the desert. And from the spies, they were 40 years from the time they left Egypt, but from the event of the spies till they entered is 38 years, because the spies happened 2 years. So if you add 38 to 40, that means Kalev was 78 years old when they crossed the Yarden River. Right, 78, 40 plus 38. And if he's now 85, that means there were 7 years of conquest. And the other thing to know is, it took 7 years to conquer all the territories that are described. And even when Yoshua died, there were large sections of the land that were not conquered. Yerushalayim, for one, was not yet conquered. But besides Yerushalayim, there were areas on the north. There were areas along the Mediterranean coast, the land of the Philistines. And there were other areas in the plain, etc. So it took 7 years to get what they got. And then it took many, many years for them to conquer the rest. And at all times, even in King David's times, there were still pockets of Amalekites and various other groups within the land of Israel that were hostile elements, that were not elements that had accepted Jewish sovereignty. So until Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon was where the Jewish empire was at its height, there was not a complete control over Eretz Israel. And of course it was very short-lived, because after Shlomo, there is the splitting of the two kingdoms, the kingdom of the 10 tribes and the kingdom of the 2 tribes. So really, we only had a very, very brief period in which there was a unified Jewish government ruling over all of the biblical boundaries of Eretz Israel. It did not happen that often. Certainly it did not happen in Yeshua's lifetime. So basically though, we come to chapter 11. And again, the way the book of Yeshua is structured is, many of the military campaigns are just described in 1 or 2 sentences. We're not given details. In other words, we are given details of only selected encounters. Right? So Yericho, we're of course given extreme detail, because Yericho first, and Yericho had some unique miracles associated with it, the falling down of the wall. We're given a detailed account of Ai, because Ai demonstrates, right, because the first time we were defeated because of Achan that took the Shalal of Yericho. So Ai teaches us the very important lesson, Kol Yisrael Arevin Zelazeh, that the entire Jewish nation is responsible for the sin of Achan, right? So Ai is mentioned. We are given the story of the war with the 5 kings, because that's the miracle of the sun stopping, and that shows us the imperative of protecting the lowly Givonim. But then when it comes to a lot of other wars, one sentence here, one sentence, one sentence, one sentence, one sentence. But then Perek Yud Aleph gives us an extended account of the war against the king of Chatzor. Now, Perek Yud Aleph is often called the Northern Campaign, because now the struggle is taking place around the Galil, right, northern the Galilee, and we will see why it's specifically mentioned. And once again, we have Yavin, the king of Chatzor. By the way, Yavin, the king of Chatzor, obviously it's not the same guy, but if you remember the story later in the book of Judges with Devorah and Barak ben Avinoam, and Sisera, the general, is waging war against them. Sisera is Sar Tzava, the general of Yavin Melech Chatzor. Okay? Now obviously, it's not the same Yavin, because this was a few hundred years later, but presumably it's the same Chatzor. So Chatzor was a very powerful city-state.
Where is Chatzor?
Chatzor is near the Yam Kinneret. It's a very powerful, I mean, there's no presently there's no city called Chatzor, I believe, but it was an ancient city. And although it says in Perek Yud Aleph that Yeshua burnt Chatzor to the ground, presumably it was either rebuilt somewhere else, or Chatzor is also the name of the Malchut, of the kingdom, even if the particular city was burnt, right? In other words, the kingdom of Chatzor continued to exist. So this is a northern pact, and this once again is a war of aggression. The same way the kings in the preceding chapter gathered to attack the Givonim, the northern kingdoms are there to attack Yehoshua directly. Right, if you look at Pasuk Hey, this is chapter 11, verse 5. Vayivadu kol hamlachim ha'ela. All of these kings came together. Vayavo'u vayachanu yachtav. And they encamped El Mei Meirom, the waters of Meirom, body of water, Lilachem in Yisrael. Now the exact site of what is Mei Meirom is not entirely clear. One candidate for Mei Meirom would be the Yam Kinneret itself, the Sea of Galilee. Another identification, based on the fact that Chatzor was further north than Kinneret, would be the body of water known as Chula. Now, there is no Chula today. Chula is the proverbial swamp that was drained. But Chula was a little lake. In other words, if you look at a map of the Yam Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, the north of the Galil, there had been a lake which had drained into the Sea of Galilee. That is called Chula. And some say the Meirom was considered to be a Chula. Now, the reason why I would call it Meirom, Meirom means high water. Because the elevation of Chula is higher than Kinneret. Kinneret is at sea level, right? The sea of sea level, therefore, the upper water. So Chula was called the upper water. And this is where the armies gathered. And basically, once again, by the way, there's an interesting expression here which indicates that the ancient world had an important technology. It talks about when it talks about the path of the battle, so it says that they pursued the enemy ad misrafot mayim. I'd look at verse 8. Misrafot mayim. What is misrafot mayim? The burning away of the water. This was a desalination plant. That in the ancient world, right, they knew that water evaporates. When you needed salt, you boil away the water and you're left with salt. So apparently, we are told that there was, I don't know what the technology was exactly, just burnt boiled water. But that is the meaning of misrafot hamayim, and therefore there was a victory. But if you look at verse 6 is where we have an unusual feature. Again, that which is disturbing in many ways. Vayomer Hashem el Yehoshua. Hashem says to Yehoshua, Al tira mipnehem, do not be afraid of these enemies that are attacking you. Ki machar ka'et hazot, tomorrow, at this time, like 24 hours from today, Anochi notein et kulam chalalim, I will make them all as corpses, as dead bodies, lifnei Yisrael, in front of the Israelites. And then it says, Es susehem ta'akir, you shall uproot their horses. And again, the commentaries explain that this means cutting the tendons of the horses' legs in a manner that the horses will not be able to run, but will also have difficulty walking. Meaning, the way it's described, and I'm not sure if I'm not a veterinarian, the way it's described is that as long as the horses graze in a pasture and don't try to trot or go quickly, they're not living in a state of pain, but it would be painful for them to exert themselves in any way. Now, well, we'll go back and see what's the point of this. V'yes markavotehem, and their chariots, which are just chariots, tisrof ba'esh, burn with fire. Yeah.
Could also ta'akir be send it to another location?
In other words, move them?
Yes, I would like to think there wouldn't be a difference. You know, I understand, you know, cutting the attendance, whatever, so you will disable them.
Yes.
But then it's really, there's no tzar ba'alei chayim here.
Well, that's the main, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So could it be like ta'akir, like sending to another location, and then when you burn the kavod, you know, the chariot, then you have nothing to connect them, and perhaps take them to another location, maybe to benefit for the Israelites, or maybe to just let them wander somewhere else.
Well, that's a very interesting translation. I have not seen that translation. Certainly, all of the commentaries on the page and Talmud does not interpret the way you're interpreting it. And indeed, they have the problem of Tzar Bali Chayim, which I'll talk about in a moment. But it's an interesting translation. In other words, uproot them from where they are and move them somewhere else. That might be, you know, again, let's see if I could find some support for that. But the way this is normally understood, this is normally understood as literally cutting the tendons of their legs, disabling them from moving. Now here, it is clearly not Yehoshua doing this on his own. This is stated in the narrative to be the command of God. And the commentaries are very troubled by it. They do raise the question. Well, it's really two questions. One is a technical question. Why does God command that here, and it's not in any other battle? In other words, what is unique about this battle that such a command would be given here? That's the technical question. And the religious and moral question is that we know that Tsar Balei Chayim, causing pain and suffering to animals, is considered to be a very serious Aveira. In fact, you know the halacha is that if any of you have pets, you should know this, that when you come home, you have to feed your animal first before you eat yourself. This is, it says in the Shema, that God will bless us. V'nasati esav b'sadcha lifhemtecha, I will give grass for your animals. V'yachalta v'savata, then you will eat and you will be satisfied. One must feed the animal before they even feed themselves. Of course, you may think, well, gee, isn't there a question? Because if you remember, when Eliezer, a few weeks from now, Eliezer is going to be looking for a wife for Yitzchak. So he says, when I ask the young lady for water, and she offers to give me water, and then my animals, that is the correct, that is the right wife for Yitzchak. And that's what Rivka did exactly. Right? Rivka first fed him, and then gave the animals. The question is, according to the halakha, assuming the halakha would be operative, that it was before the Torah was given, but under this etiquette of value, the animals should be fed first. But the truth is, there's a simple distinction. I must feed my animals before I drink myself. And maybe Eliezer should have fed his animals first. But when I'm offering you, you come in with your dog, I'm not supposed to say, let me feed your dog first, because that is actually disrespectful to a human being. I'm supposed to say, let me offer you food, and then you say, well, I want to feed my animal first. So when it comes to Rivka offering hospitality to another human being, it's very clear that the way you respect, the way you show kavod for a human being, is you offer them first. You don't say, let me feed the dog first. But be it as it may, Tsar Balei Chayim is very significant. In fact, we could have a whole talk about the permissibility of animal experimentation. Now, halacha is reasonable in this matter, meaning to say, halacha does not embrace the extreme view of animal liberation. Right? PETA, you know, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, you know, they're willing to, you know, to kill 20 people to save a chimpanzee. They'll blow up a thing, whatever it is. And we do not believe that animals are morally equivalent to human beings. Human beings are made in the image of God. Animals can contribute much to human welfare in many, many ways, but they're not in the image of God. Consequently, for example, one is allowed to inflict pain on animals if there's no other way for there to be a vital human purpose. By that I mean, if you're testing, let's say, a cancer drug or the like, and there's no other way you could really test it other than perhaps inflicting pain on animals, halacha basically says you're allowed to do so, but you must minimize the pain. On the other hand, when the need is not such a great need, for you're testing makeup or cosmetics, or maybe a fur coat as well, halacha would basically say, hey, you know, just because you want some less significant benefit that you want to get, that doesn't justify it. So we would basically say, to save a human life, you know, you kill and even hurt as many animals as you must, although you try to minimize the pain. But for purposes which are less important, what Tsar Balei Chayim trick is, so in other words, it's a balancing process. Human needs are more significant than animal welfare, but the human need has to be very important in order to compromise animal welfare. Now, I understand that Johns Hopkins is very concerned. I just got my Johns Hopkins alumni magazine. You know, the federal government does have fairly strict standards, although they don't enforce it that much, with animal safety and welfare for experiments. But they exempted, they had never covered rats and mice before. They cover monkeys and dogs. And now the federal government, NIH, issued a bunch of rules that if you're getting federal funding, all of the animal welfare regulations have to be applied to mice as well. So the universities are going crazy. They say they will not be able to comply with it. And that was a whole debate, and they're blaming PETA as having influence on the lobbying process, or whatever it is. Now, another interesting point is that, ironically, this is strange, but there is no prohibition against killing an animal, as you might affect. After all, shechita is permitted. There is only a prohibition against causing pain to an animal. So if an animal dies instantaneously, that's all right. Right? The problem is the torture.
But that would apply to here. Why torture people?
No, I didn't answer the question. I'm making the question stronger. That's what I'm saying. Right? I'm just building up to the discussion. I wanted to just start about Lechaim a little bit just to give us a background of the concept.
The answer would be because horses at that were not for riding, but for killing the Jews by the war. They were war instruments.
Right, well, that's very true, that horses in the ancient armies were used as part of the war. But again, the question becomes, if better to kill. In other words, I'm saying it's better to kill an animal than to give an animal pain and suffering. That's why for somebody called me up, for example, the other few weeks ago. I mean, you know, on one hand it's humorous, on the other hand I also understand it very much. You know, rabbis always get calls about the people on life support and when do you think this. When I was in Israel in the summer, I got a call from a frantic woman whose cat had some terminal condition. And the veterinarian wanted to aggressively pursue life support. And she felt, it's interesting, now the doctors are telling you for human beings, let's not push it. But anyway, and she wanted to know, did Judaism permit euthanasia of animals, or is that considered killing? I mean, the short answer basically is that Judaism prohibits inflicting pain on animals. It does not prohibit killing an animal. And as a result, the notion of putting a dog or a cat to sleep if it is suffering is a permissible response. And in fact, not only permissible, but the imperative of preventing pain and suffering might say what you're absolutely not allowed to do in the case of a human being may be exactly what you're obligated to do in the case of an animal. It's a different standard, per se.
One of the reasons the seven nations were destroyed was because they had stooped to the lowest of human beings.
Yes.
And one of the things I thought or learned was that they also stooped to use their horses in an immoral way, especially the soldiers out on the field. In which case, where would you bury all these horses? Human corpse you can throw into one grave or put them in the... move them to the...
Right.
So
where would you put the horses?
Disengage the horses because they might attack the Bnei Israel. If they were used to sleeping or being
We'll discuss that. In other words, there might be possibilities that these horses were dangerous weapons, vicious weapons that might turn upon them, etc. In fact, there's even a condition. Where did I read about it? I was just reading about certain strains of German shepherds have this thing. Where either they get nervous, it's a whole psychiatric condition that some dogs have, where they just turn on their owners. They get frightened out of fear, and they just turn on their owners without any warning. But you're suggesting that perhaps. Well, okay, I'll get you. Okay, you're getting a little ahead of myself.
Should have turned on Hitler.
Well, yeah. Hitler had healthy dogs. Okay, it's too bad. But anyway, so the thing is this. But again, just to flesh out Tzar Bali Chaim a little bit. Now, the Gemara tells us an amazing story. You know, the author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And the Gemara tells us a story that the last 13 years of his life, he suffered tremendous intestinal pains. It may have been a form of cancer or blockage. And it says, you know why he suffered this? This was considered to be a divine punishment that God brought a very righteous man. And that is, he was once walking in the marketplace, and a calf was being led to slaughter. And the calf ran over to him and tucked its head under his arm. And he pushed the calf away and he said to the calf, "Go, this is your destiny." I mean, you know, you're supposed to be slaughtered, don't come to me. And it was decreed in heaven that because he did not have compassion over God's animals, he would suffer. Now then, and he suffered for many years, but then look what happened. At one time, he got miraculously better. His cleaning help. There was his maid was cleaning out the house, and she came across a nest of field mice, and she wanted to sweep them out. And he said, "Let them stay." It says, "Rachamav al kol ma'asav." God's mercy is on all of His creatures, and in that very second, he got instantaneously better, because it was said in Shemaya, now that He has shown compassion for the animal, you know, He rectified his chait. Now everything is fine. And of course, we know that the manhigim, the Medrash makes the point that all of the manhigim of Klal Yisrael were always shepherds. The Avot were shepherds. Moshe Rabbeinu was a shepherd. David HaMelech was taken as a shepherd. And part of the idea is that one who shows compassion and kindness to take care of the sheep is capable of now being a leader of Jewish people. Now, in fact, you know, all of us have heard this, all of us know this, but it's interesting that I came across a book that was written by an Arab shepherd describing what it's like to take care of sheep. It's very interesting. If you don't really know in detail what it's like to take care of sheep, mm-hmm. we talk about Hashem is my shepherd. So he describes this. This is an amazing thing. He says sheep are very, very timid. They don't see very well. So the whole world looks very, very fuzzy to them. And that's why they're frightened. That's part of why they have a herd mentality, is they don't really see what anything that's around them. They just have to follow the closest sheep or whatever it is. Sometimes they're so top-heavy because of their wool that if they fall over, they cannot stand themselves up. They need a shepherd to position them. They can't see, and the shepherd has to carry sheep, lambs, to the water. So there really is a sense of really taking care of someone and something that is incapable of doing, taking care of themselves. And that's the concept of Hashem being a shepherd. So all of this shows us the great importance of Tsar Balei Chayim. Again, it is not predicated on the PETA idea that humans and animals are the same. In fact, it's very interesting. The founder of the animal liberation movement, the spiritual head of animal liberation, is an Australian ethicist, Peter Singer, who is actually coming to the United States. It's very controversial. Princeton University. His mother has Alzheimer's. Yeah. It's interesting. Peter Singer was offered the chair of a new ethics program in Princeton University. And it's very, very controversial. And Peter Singer wrote two books, and he's written more than that, but he has two books which exemplify his philosophy of life. His first book was Animal Liberation, in which he argues that animals have the same rights as human beings, and you can't slaughter them, you can't kill them, you can't imprison them, you can't experiment upon them. His second book is a book about putting defective newborn children to death. Because he basically says that their life isn't worth a lot, they're suffering, and they are a drain on society. In fact, Peter Singer makes this point. He says, I'm quoting him, this is not my philosophy. His point is that it is not morally justifiable, let's say, to spend $100,000 keeping a retarded person alive when you could give that money to Africa and feed, let's say, 300 people. What gives you, in fact, even to, and even, forget about retirement, says even your own son, what gives you the right to spend your money on your son when there could be 10, 20, or 100 people that could be benefited?
Kind of good point.
This is his point. And so somebody said, well, how much of your salary do you keep? I mean, and he gives, he says he's not perfect, but he says he gives around 30% of his royalties to. So he says he gives a lot. But his basic idea was that there is no moral justification for preferring your family over the world as a whole. This is his argument. And that's why he says that, we should give our money to where it could help a lot of people and not focus on our family's needs or whatever it is. So the paradox is that Peter Singer's mother, unfortunately, developed Alzheimer's. And, he's fairly well off, even with the 30% that he gives away. So he put her in a very nice group home, etc. And somebody said, well, mm-hmm. Why don't you give this to Africa? He says. So he says, it's different when it's your mother. What can I tell you? I don't remember his book, but there's a big article. Animal Liberation is the first book. But here's the part I want to say. On one hand, look at the opposite idea here. On one hand, he elevates the rights of animals to be equal to every human being, which might be great if human beings were elevated to a standard. But at the same time, human life gets pushed down. Meaning to say, when you equate human with animal, what you get is not a heightening of standard. What you get is a lowering of standard. And that's why I don't want to prove things by anecdotes, but Hitler was a vegetarian. Again, this doesn't mean that vegetarianism leads to atrocity, but the concept is that there is a principle in the moral life that when you take a certain aspect of morality and you carry it out to an extreme, you will tend to diminish another aspect because you don't live in a balanced hierarchy and weighing of values. And that's why one who attaches an exaggerated importance to animal welfare, I say exaggerated importance, will often diminish their sense of human welfare. And thus, PETA can bomb clinics and kill, 30 people in the desire to save a chimpanzee. Now again, this is not justifying the pain inflicted on animals. I mean, halakha clearly and absolutely condemns tsar balei chayim. Ad kedei kach that one might even say, I know people who do not eat the veal as a protest to the way animals are treated. And that's a very, very legitimate point. Meaning, if somebody were to tell me, I don't eat meat because I believe it's morally wrong to kill animals for human consumption, I would have to say that that's not correct from a Jewish perspective, because God clearly says, God says in the Torah, animals may be killed for human consumption. So one is challenging the Torah's morality. But if one says, I eat meat because the animals are mistreated as a preparation to their slaughter, that's a totally legitimate argument, because God does not allow animals to be mistreated in that way. So it all depends. Are you substituting your moral judgment for the Torah, or are you basically taking an additional step in furtherance of what the Torah considers to be morally valid? Yeah.
Well, excuse an extremist. Well, you said that, how he has a lot of powers, his ideas have raised the consciousness of other people towards animals, and I think it's like Sweden now.
Yeah.
I think they have laws concerning cattle that they can be raised, and chickens.
Right.
Right.
That's a good thing. I'm not against. I'm for. I'm not only not against. I'm for animal welfare, and I'm for.
But his extreme views. I mean, his views are extreme. But some people who, didn't care, didn't think about it. Also, might think about it. Doesn't prove things for animals.
Well, like anything else. Very often, extremism is a way of getting other people somewhere in the middle.
Right.
To pay attention, and that's legitimate. But all I'm saying is that. It's not just a question that he's extreme, but the philosophical premises of his argument we would also reject, because the philosophical premise of his argument is that all sentient, all feeling creatures are morally equivalent to each other. That's his premise, and that's a premise that Genesis rejects when it talks about human beings are made in the image of Hashem. And so it's not just he's extreme, but we would reject the philosophical premise of his argument. Yeah.
The Indian don't even anything that crawls or whatever.
Right. What is that religion? They wear the face mask so they won't inhale an insect or something. How do you pronounce it? It's the J-A-I-N. Jain, I don't know if it's pronounced Jainus, but it is an Indian religion that they will not even inhale without a mask over their mouth. I'm sorry, did you?
Oh, yeah. First of all, comment. I think in Oregon a few years ago they had a situation where they were having to decide where to spend their welfare money.
Yes.
And whether to inoculate children, like 5,000 children or 2,000 children, and then to cut benefits to older people with kidney transplants, heart transplants, and all that. And they did decide in favor of the children in favor of having the inoculation. And not giving money for major surgeries like that a lot of times don't last.
England too. Well, I'll tell you the truth. Those are very tragic decisions. But on the other hand, I think they're justifiable. I think they're justifiable. Meaning to say, if I'm a third person, and I'm approached by different people, or society is approached by different demands on resources, so I think it is reasonable to put the resources in the place where it'll do the most good. However. No, but it's true. In other words, I think your mother, it's not just an emotional thing. I think there's also a logical and rational basis for that. And that is that the nature of humanity is that we do form special bonds with our family, with our community. And you can't have a philosophical system that works in opposition to fundamental laws of human nature. You cannot tell a parent, your son is no more important than any other child in the world. What gives you the right to care about your son more? That is a philosophical statement that is inconsistent with human nature, and therefore it could not be true, meaning you can't live by that regimen, as he himself admits when push comes to shove. So I think there's a very big difference between a legislature allocating funds and what a parent is permitted to do for their child. You know, it is true in an ultimate sense. It is true. You know, your son is, from the world's view, a given child is not more important than any other child. But you can't tell a parent that. Yeah.
Are each man is God's image, and therefore has infinite value.
Right.
So that if you're confronted with one person who needs something,
yes,
you can't say, well, there are 10 people out there somewhere. I mean, isn't there as opposed to utilitarianism? Okay, if I do some experiments on living children, and I find a cure for a disease, then other thousands will now, am I allowed to do this on healthy children?
No. Okay, well, yeah, but again, technically there's a difference. You cannot say, I want to, if I kill this person, I do an experiment on him, I can save 100 lives. You cannot do that. On the other hand, if I only have one dialysis machine, and the question is, do I give it to an 85-year-old person who with dialysis will survive another 6 months, or do I give it to a 15-year-old who will be able to have a normal life expectancy? Well, you have to make a choice. Clearly, even though all life is of infinite value, you make the choice where it'll, you know, do the most.
Don't you pray God this way?
Well, it's unavoidable. In other words, what's the alternative? Is the alternative to do nothing, then two people die? Or is the alternative to flip a coin? Now, you know, that case in Britain that we just had, about the two twins being separated, that's a hard question, right? Because here, if you do nothing at all, two will die. If you do something, one will live, but the other one will die for sure. So are you allowed to really kill one in order to save another? The normal halachic answer is no. But in a case where one will, one has less of a prospect of living than the other, you're allowed to allocate the heart to the one who will have the best chance, which was done. So I think halacha would legitimate the decision that was made. The parents originally did not want that decision to be made. The court actually forced them to do it.
When people ask if you're playing God,
yep.
Isn't that we are made in the image of God?
That's right.
Sort of making.
So you can never say, I want to be patur from making a decision. Yep.
I have problems with separating completely individual decisions, let's say, about your own son versus the societal division.
Yeah.
Because there are I think the two things are related, because you are condoning a distribution of income in society,
yes,
that enables that one individual to make a decision over another.
So the question then becomes, so is the alternative mass socialism a la kibbutz, in which all resource, one might say, the only logical and moral solution, although I don't think Singer advocates total socialism in that sense, or communism, is that all property belong to the society, and then there be an allocation in an equitable and moral way. Treated.
Well,
scary.
Even in the selection, doesn't say it's all or nothing, but yeah. This is a major difference. How much of the society's resources are being put into the general good and individual good.
But there's a tremendous question here, because let's imagine that we were creating a Jewish society in which resources would be allocated according to the morality of the Torah, for a second, right? And there is, of course, no place on earth where that happens, even and maybe especially in the state of Israel. So here is the problem. Saving a life is the most important value in Judaism. So let's put it this way. Every time we build a public library, every time we have a concert hall, every time we have an arts museum, every time we build a stadium, there are people who are dying because an equivalent amount of money was taken out of potential health care. If, for example, we have a shortage of dialysis machines, part of that is because if we wouldn't build a stadium, we would have more money for dialysis machines. So the question becomes, if Pikuach Nefesh is the single value, then how could we have libraries? How could we have, schools, I guess we need, because otherwise you won't have the doctors. But the question becomes, is there room for anything else in society other than expenditures that will say, obviously that's absurd, because no one has ever said 100 cents of every dollar should go to health care. So what you see here is an unusual thing, that on the societal level, a society can look at what expenditures will bring the greatest benefit to society as a whole, and that includes cultural and aesthetic, even if it means there will be individuals that are going to suffer. Meaning, I as an individual must do everything I can to sustain life. Society as an aggregate can look at other considerations.
There's a lot of gradation.
I understand. Mm-hmm. But clearly, a societal decision is not the same as the individual decision that I must make when I'm confronted with a situation. Okay, but by way of all this introduction, just to bring us back to our problem. So our problem now is a strong problem, right? Our problem basically is, well, gee, Tsar Balei Chaim is a big deal, it's a bad thing. And God here is commanding that we do something to the animal that apparently causes it to have Tsar Balei Chaim. Now the Radak himself says the following. I don't know if it completely answers the question, but the Radak, Rav David Kimchi, one of the great medieval commentators, says that we know, of course, in the ancient world, horses were very, very powerful tools of war. And we know that the Torah itself was concerned that the Jewish people would accumulate too many horses. Remember, they were told, a king cannot accumulate horses lest he go back to Egypt, because Egypt was the great breeding ground for the horses. And even David HaMelech says in Tehillim, Sheker, we say this in our prayers, Sheker Hasus L'Teshua. The horse is a false source of salvation, meaning to say that sometimes armies that have horses became arrogant and confident in their victory and did not realize that God was the source of victory. So the Radak says that God wanted to be sure that the Jewish people would not be accumulating an inventory of horses that they could use in battle, because then they would attribute their military successes to their horses rather than to God. And that's why the horse, Sheker Hasus, Hasus L'Teshua. The horse is a false source of salvation. And it says, Lo Bigvurat Hasus Yechpatz. It's in Tehillim. God does not find pleasure in the Gevurat Hasus, the strength and the power of the horse. Right? The horse was very good. You ever seen these battle horses? They're very, very frightening. Like if they get up on their legs. Now, the problem I have with the Radak, though, is that if the only point was that the Jewish people should not accumulate an inventory of horses that are usable in war, one would have thought that killing them would have done the job, as opposed to the Tsar Balei Chaim. Now, the Radak says no. The Radak says killing them is less humane because this way they get to live and eat and etc. But it's hard to imagine. Now, what you suggested, I think, is an interesting explanation, that perhaps there was a fear. The fear would be that the horses themselves might be like vicious animals that might attack the Israelites. But even that doesn't explain why not to kill them.
Well, I'm talking about the morality.
I understand. Yeah.
I mean, they probably would really speak with them. You know, it's much easier to go along with a knife and several attendants than to kill thousands of horses that would be, screaming out and I know what. I mean,
So this was a more discreet procedure.
I think the situation of war and whatever, I think this is what they might have had to have done.
Okay.
So
I'm not sure. There is a description of this as something that was not necessarily a painful procure.
When you cut a tendon, cut through the flesh. Yeah. I mean, they were still surgeons. So there's swelling.
Right.
Well, actually, it describes, or maybe I misspoke, it describes here not so much the tendon, although some translate it that way. It describes a removal of the hoof, which might be a different procedure. Removing the hoof would not give them the ability to... Yeah, okay, well... Yeah, okay. Yeah. Do you have a horse or...
No, that's fine. Okay.
All right, but be it as it may, the issue of that bestiality and even sexual relations with animals was also something that was common, and that also was a concern about not accumulating horses for those immoral purposes.
Yeah. The immoral purposes were decided by the human
beings. Oh yes, I'm not saying punishing the horses, but I'm saying putting them out of commission would also disable that type of improper. Well, there is a halacha though. It's interesting. The halacha does discuss. It's in the chumash. That when there is improper relations with animals, the animals are to be executed as well. Simply because this was an instrumentality of an evil act being done. In fact, according to the halacha, the animal is brought to a bet din. And the court paskins that the animal should be put to death. In fact, there are pictures from the Middle Ages that talk about that have these big ox being brought into a judicial proceeding.
I don't think anyone can say that animals can be accused of immorality because they don't have the mental capacities to be responsible for their choices.
No, I'm not saying that they're being punished for their sin. I am saying that when it is an instrumentality for evil, we put it away.
But then if you count them as an instrument, you're counting them as something less than alive. I don't
know.
Getting rid of a gun.
I know, but they're not a gun. They're not a thing.
The killing of the animal though is not in itself a problem because that doesn't involve tzar bali chayim. I mean, you're still back to the issue that cutting or removing the hoof or cutting the tendon to disable them appears to be a bigger problem.
So you can't kill a gun because it's an inanimate object.
But you destroy a dangerous dog.
Well, for example,
the idea of caring for your animals is just kind of, seems to me, a little bit incompatible with this.
The truth is the animal is both. In other words, the animal has needs and hungers for which you must take care of, but it can also be employed as an instrument for nefarious designs. In other words, you can have a dual characterization there, and consequently when it's used as an instrumentality for evil, there is a procedure for executing the animal, not prolonging its suffering, just getting rid of it. The person is chayav mita. It's a capital crime. Bestiality is a... Of course, there has to be warning of all those procedural rules, but it is a chayav mita, yeah. For sure.
Do you have an answer?
No, I don't. I'm just... I don't have a good answer on this. As I say, the only insight the Radak offers us is that God did not want the Jewish people to have an accumulation of inventory of military horses, because that would give them the arrogance that their horses were responsible for their victory. And the Radak says they were not killed because he says destroying that which is useful would have been a violation of the Isur of Lo Tashchit, right? You're not allowed to destroy.
Yeah,
but I don't get it, because it seems if you disable the horses, they can't do anything anyway. So it's not clear why killing them would have been a greater act of destruction. Oh, so you're saying they're still usable for reproduction. That's interesting.
Yeah, but then it negates the whole thing about accumulating.
Well, that's the other thing, yeah. I mean, the other thing, what does that mean? Let's say they reproduce. Are you going to repeat this cycle indefinitely? Because if they reproduce, you'll eventually have your inventory anyway. But I guess, though, by that time, the conquest would be completed. So it's
and
like
you wouldn't need them for war.
Yeah, so that
they
wouldn't be used for war. Or they could sell them, yeah. Yeah, it is a problem, and again, we can point out that this is the only war in which this was ever done. Why is that so? I guess we have to assume that this army just had more horses. The other armies didn't employ those horses. I guess we're lucky that they didn't have the elephants like Hannibal. You know. They were just horses, yeah.
I'm struck by something today, and I am repeatedly when I listen to you. I do work in the hotel, so often... your interpretation of what you tell us about how such a sound psychological basis.
it seems like I'm sitting in my office with people. It seems intra-conflict. And the struggle over what the right thing is to do, what the wrong thing is to do, or bubbles up from the unconscious. How do you introduce it? How do you deal with it? There's something so Jewish about doing this most popular. And I'm not surprised, you know, that Freud was a Jew, even though he wasn't a religious Jew,
right.
That so many of the psychiatrists, at least when, I don't know about the new population coming in, but certainly up until the last 10 years, was overwhelmingly Jewish.
Yes.
And they studied the animated literature, and they dealt with this kind of struggle, a moral, call it whatever you will, moral struggle, psychic struggle.
Right.
It's just amazing to me when I listen to you over and over again on the structure.
Well, you know, Freud himself came from 13 generations of rabbis. His father was not a rabbi. His father broke the chain. But he came from a very long long line. He himself had a traditional bar mitzvah. And he knew, maybe he forgot, but he knew how to read Hebrew, translate Hebrew.
I mean, even Woody Allen has nothing to do with religion. I mean, he's so
good. The Pintle Yid. Yeah, it's very true. But again, this is the issue we always have to grapple with, because on one hand, halacha, in fact, Maimonides writes about this. Maimonides writes in one of his in his introduction to the Mishnah, that some people have an attitude about mitzvot that they're not supposed to make sense. He actually says, he criticizes this, but he says, you know, some people feel if I try to make sense of a mitzvah, then I'm doing it because it makes sense to me, and I'm not doing it out of total obedience to God. So they actually praise themselves by doing things that specifically don't make sense. They feel the less sensible it is, the more obedient I am by doing it. This is a school of thought that Maimonides quotes, but he then criticizes this as being an incorrect attitude, because he says God gave us mitzvot not merely as arbitrary ways of making sure we're obedient to Him. Like, you know, as if he would give us senseless things, as I want you to stand on your head with your left hand behind your ear, just so I want to be sure you listen to me. But rather, God gave us mitzvot so that we should become certain types of people. We should develop personality characteristics. We should develop midot. We should develop understandings. And therefore, Maimonides says you have to have an awareness and a consciousness of what these mitzvot are supposed to teach you. Because if you specifically take the idea, this is not supposed to make sense, but I'm doing it anyway, you are shutting yourself off from being transformed by what the mitzvot are designed to teach you. Right? This is Maimonides' view. Now, the truth is, the view that Maimonides discredits is a view. In other words, it's not a view that's totally absurd. And you sometimes see that. Yeah. But as I say, so that creates the problem that when we look at mitzvot and we have great, great difficulty in trying to see what the message of the mitzvah is, we still have to try to extract some type of way of reconciling it. Not with our personal morality, because after all, if my personal morality disagrees with the Torah, I just have to say I'm wrong, but to try to make it consistent with the moral ethic of the Torah itself. In other words, is what the Torah telling me here consistent with what the Torah is telling me overall? And that's a difficult process when you come to issues like this. And again, I realize I'm not giving you a satisfactory answer, because it's a question that I also have difficulty with.
Rabbi, is it a balance of, like, you know, faith? When you say you do it to be obedient, it's a matter of faith.
Yes.
Like in the Akedah.
Yes. There is a point in which you recognize the limitations of human reasoning.
Right.
And you then say, I surrender. There is certainly the idea of surrender.
But nevertheless, there were lessons we learned psychologically from the story as it followed the Akedah. You know, he never spoke to Sarah again. He didn't speak to his son again, and Sarah died, and all these things we then talk about.
Yep.
Those were consequences for the intricacies.
That's correct. And in fact, people forget that one of the lessons of the Akedah, people forget this. You know, we all say the lesson of the Akedah, that's certainly a very important lesson, is Avraham's willingness of total surrender. That, of course, is the primary lesson. But there's another lesson that God eventually tells Avraham, you have to be willing to give up your son, but that's not how I want to be worshipped. Meaning God says, don't do it. There is a very important significance in don't doing it too.
Avraham never spoke to Yitzchak again?
Avraham didn't speak to Sarah again.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's not recorded. I mean, you know, again, it's not recorded that Avraham spoke right. to Yitzchak. So again, one could draw different conclusions from that. Yeah.
In the Torah, there's I don't know how many times it's mentioned, but it says, you know, if you don't follow my ways, I will do all these
right.
terrible things to you.
Right.
I will wipe you out.
Right.
I mean, is that what's happened over the centuries with all these?
Well, I don't want to get in trouble. You know, this is always a very, very painful and controversial issue. You know, the issue of whether Jewish suffering should be understood as a punishment for sin or the like. Certainly there are aspects of it. The important thing we have to remember is that does not justify the evildoer. Meaning to say, evildoers who do evil do so out of their free will and their autonomy, for which they will be held accountable. It is not for one human being to inflict pain on another human being and say you deserve it. But why Hashem allows things to happen, there are certainly elements of what God says in the Torah.
What made me think that because of the response is that, you know, we were given the 13
right.
misspoke to
right.
follow,
right.
Which were not easy.
Right.
The difficult task and responsibility. And, you know, it's not like in those days a lot of people were drawn to Judaism, whereas, you know, in the time of Jesus, like his message was just so easy that a lot of these pagans came in droves and droves. I mean, that throughout the centuries, it's so much, the demands are so much easier.
Yep, for
and,
sure.
And yet these people found their way to God a different way,
right.
but it's so much easier.
That's right.
We still have the 613 myths left.
Well, yeah, don't... Well, you know. Well, first of all, let's not exaggerate. There's nobody in this room that has 613 mitzvot to do. And the average, it's around 150. So it's not today. So it's not that bad. Well, once again, that is the idea of the so-called chosen people. Chosenness is responsibility. Chosenness is obligation. Chosenness is the need to create what is called a Kiddush Hashem in the world. And that is a burden, but it's a burden that one takes with joy and privilege that they were given such a burden. Sure, it's easier, but it's easier to be a plant instead of a human being. I mean, basically, the holiness of one's mission creates a sense of burden and responsibility, but one undertakes it with a joyous commitment, a privilege. But you know, you're right. You know, it's easier to be a non-Jew than a Jew. A Jew has more obligations, but there's a certain privilege in that. That doesn't mean, again, and I say this all the time, and it's very, very important, that doesn't mean one looks down at people who aren't Jewish. Obviously, the idea of Tzelem Elokim, the image of God, absolutely applies to non-Jews. But nevertheless, there are special responsibilities of being Jewish. So that's why when we often feel bad that the world applies a double standard to a Jew. Right? They say, the whole world can do all of this and nobody complains, and when a Jew does something in Israel or whatever it is, we get condemned. It is unfortunate that the rest of the world, you know, puts us on a different standard, but the truth of the matter is, Jewish people are supposed to be, at least vis-a-vis God, are supposed to be in a different standard. Just because everybody does something is not a justification for you know, us to do it. You know, to say that we're no worse than the morality of the world around us is not really a ringing endorsement of what we should be. Okay. All right, but again, so I'll leave this kind of with a question, but this concept is an unusual feature. And then it goes on and says that Chatzor, the city of Chatzor, was totally burnt with fire. Meaning the other cities were not, but Chatzor was totally destroyed. As far as I can see in the book of Yoshua, there are only two cities which were totally decimated physically. The buildings were destroyed. One was Yericho, and of course Yericho is even stricter because Yericho was not allowed to be rebuilt. And the other is Chatzor. And although, as I indicated in the story of Sisera, Chatzor did reemerge, but that could have been on a different site. It's not entirely clear. And then it goes on and talks about other cities that were conquered. Again, the one sentence ones. In other words, after those details. And if you look at verse 19, look at verse 19, 11, chapter 11, verse 19. Lo hayitair Asher Hishlima El Bnei Yisrael. There was no city that made shalom with Bnei Yisrael. Bilti Hachivi Yoshvei Giv'on. Except for the Chivites who dwelt in the city of Giv'on. In other words, the Giv'onim. Et HaKol Lakhu BaMilchama. Every inch of Eretz Yisrael, except for Giv'on, had to be taken by military conquest. Meaning, shalom may have been offered to all sorts of cities, but nobody took them up on it. And then, there's an inventory of all of the kings that Yoshua conquered, and if you count those kings, you will see a listing of 31 malachim, and that's why Chazal constantly referred to the Lamed Aleph, Shloshim V'Achat Malachim, that were conquered in Eretz Yisrael over 7 years. Now, there is a very strange Chazal about Yoshua. You know, it took 7 years, and this was not the complete conquest. And it says Yoshua actually took longer than he had to, because Yoshua had a premonition that as soon as he completed the conquest of the land, as his mission was to conquer the land, he would die. So he kind of stretched out the conquest a little bit in order to be ma'arich yamim, in order to have arichut yamim. But this was considered to be something that God was not happy with. And because of this, Yoshua actually died earlier than he should have. Because God always tells Yoshua, you will, you know, you'll be like Moshe. Moshe lived 120 years. Yoshua only lived 110 years. And it says he lost the 10 years of his life because in an attempt to prolong his life, he extended the conquest. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually took away. He would have given him 120, and instead he gave him 110. Now, I think we don't have to assume this was a conscious motivation on the part of Yoshua. Presumably, he had all sorts of strategic reasons for not doing something, etc. But Chazal are testifying that within his mind there was a certain element of a desire to prolong his life. By the way, this is to be contrasted with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, it is said, if you remember, the last war that Moshe Rabbeinu waged was a war, this is in the book of Bamidbar, a war against the Midianites, because the Midianites had Balak, Bilam and everything. And Hashem told Moshe, go wage war against the Midianites, and then you will die. And the Pasuk talks about the great enthusiasm and alacrity that Moshe Rabbeinu did in starting the war. Meaning, Rashi makes the point, even though Moshe knew this would be his last campaign, he immediately started it. So that's to be contrasted with Yoshua, who is accused of being a little dilatory in getting these things accomplished. Okay. All right, maybe we will stop here. And next time, I think we're up to Perek Yud Gimel, verse 13. Now, just to give a word of introduction, basically, verse 13 and 14 still deal with conquest. So until the end of chapter 14, the subject of the book is kibush, conquest. And then come a number of chapters which deal with chaluka, division. Now, that's very interesting because it's quite complicated, and we'll discuss this. It's very, very intricate. After the land was conquered, it then had to be apportioned among the various tribes, and the book of Yoshua gives us the tribal boundaries of each shevet. Unfortunately, unfortunately, as you might expect, you can look at different maps, but all the maps are conjectural. Because we don't have precise identification for the various place names, we do not have a definitive map of where each of the tribes were. And we know approximately, we know, for example, that Zvulun was on the sea coast, and we know that Yehuda is around Yerushalayim. We know approximately. But the Pasuk tries to give you in great detail the exact boundaries. One point about Chalukah, though, that is worthy of note, just in terms of our Chalukah's division. It took 7 years to actually apportion the land, not just to the tribes, that just took one day, but for each landowner to get a definitive plat. And we'll discuss why that was so complicated. But two things to note. Number one, Shevet Levi, the Levites, did not have a defined territory in the land of Israel. Rather, there were 48 Levite cities which were scattered through the length and breadth of all the lands, and therefore within the territory of each Shevet there was an Ir Levi, which makes perfect sense because the Leviim are the spiritual teachers and mentors of the Jewish people, and therefore every tribe should have Levite cities. That's one point to keep in mind. Another point to keep in mind, however, is there was only one other tribe that had a similar phenomenon. That is Shimon, the tribe of Shimon. They were not scattered throughout, but the tribe of Shimon had isolated cities that were muvla, that were absorbed in the tribe of Yehuda. Which means Shimon was the only tribe that did not have all of its territory as a contiguous, continuous block. Now, it's interesting. This is evidence, Chazal say, from Moshe Rabbeinu's farewell blessing. If you remember, if you look in the Chumash, in Zos HaBracha, we read on Simchat Torah, Moshe gives a blessing to Reuven, and then he skips Shimon and gives a blessing to Yehuda. And part of that is so because Shimon's territory was dispersed within. And if you look at Yaakov's blessing, if you remember, Yaakov cursed Shimon and Levi on his deathbed, and he said, Achal keim b'Yaakov, I will divide them among Jacob, va'afitzeim, and I will scatter them in Israel. Now, based on this idea, it turns out the following. The dispersion of Shimon and Levi could be understood based on Yaakov's feeling that they had an unpredictable temper and a certain aggressive tendency. Remember, they wiped out the city of Shechem? The concept was, keep them apart. Don't let them unify in a single confederation. So it's interesting that on one hand, you can look at the Levi dispersion in a very, very positive way. It's a way of the spiritual instruction permeating. But the other way of looking at it is, just as Shimon was kept dispersed, as Yaakov said, so was Levi kept dispersed. So that's why Levi is very paradoxical. Shimon was cursed, and Shimon seemed to have remained cursed on some level. Levi was cursed just as Shimon, but Levi seemed to have been reborn in some type of different form, where the zealousness and even the aggression of Levi somehow became channeled into a passionate connection to holiness. It's interesting, because insofar as Yaakov is concerned, Shimon and Levi are peas in a pod. But once you get to Moshe, because Moshe himself was a Levi, once you get to Moshe Rabbeinu, there's a very sharp differentiation in which Shimon is not even mentioned. And Levi, if you look in Zot HaBracha, Levi is given a very, very elevated bracha. And yet, there's still a recognition that Levi's passion for holiness is also potentially dangerous, because the passion for holiness can turn into an aggression and an intolerance. So you can look at the splitting in two different ways, as either a good thing or as a protection against a bad thing. Okay, but we'll talk about next time the very, very intricate system for dividing up the land. It's a quite complicated system.
Why were these lands, the last three, Gaza, Gaza, and Ashdod, not captured?
Well, the simple is because these coastal cities were the Philistines, and the Philistines were considered to be the fiercest of the nations.
But we have Hashem on our side. I mean, Hashem was fierce.
Well, yeah, but the idea...